This is an oral history project of architecture and fine arts for the Heritage Education Commission. We are interviewing Mr. Paul Christensen, who is the director of the choir for Concordia College. Paul, would you be kind enough to share with us something about your background in terms of how you came to Moorhead and to Concordia College?
Well, I received a letter from the president, and he asked me to come. That's how I happened to come to Concordia. Mm-hmm. I was at the time in Rochester, New York, studying music at Eastman, and I had two letters, one from a New York college and one from this one, and I visited the New York college, and I knew, had known Concordia because I grew up in Minnesota. And after looking at the college in New York, I decided to come to Moorhead.
So you did undertake formal training then in the field of music before coming to Concordia?
Oh, yes. I started piano when I was in third grade and did some writing then in those early days. And my father was a musician, so he helped me learn to play and to write.
How did you develop your interest in your area of work, Paul?
Well, it was all around me. When my father was a musician, and he was doing a lot of writing and playing on the piano and played an organ in the church, and so it naturally was a part of the household.
So then it was primarily your father and the fact that you were exposed to it as a child.
Right. I know that he gave violin lessons to the laundry man's son in Northfield, and then he just, along with it, he gave counterpoint lessons to him, and I joined the class, step two. So I started studying counterpoint when I was quite young also.
How would you evaluate the work that you have done in the Fargo-Moorhead community with the choir at Concordia?
How I would evaluate it?
Yes.
Well, that wouldn't be for me to do. It's for Moorhead to do, I guess.
Do you feel that your work has been accepted by the community?
Oh, not particularly. It's better accepted outside.
Why not?
I don't know. We have always standing ovations when we sing in other towns, but not always in Moorhead.
Has this always been the case in terms of community support?
Oh, it's off and on, I suppose. I don't pay too much attention to it. Like getting any other teacher, I go about my business and...
Who has influenced and supported or assisted you in the development of your program at Concordia, Paul?
Well, I suppose you'd have to say my father first, since he was a choral director and choral composer, although he was an instrumentalist as well. He played violin and clarinet, piano, organ, and so on. So he would be number one, and number two would be Dimitri Metropoulos, who was the symphony conductor in Minneapolis for many years, and he was my second most important teacher, I would say.
What did you find at Concordia in terms of the music department when you came here?
There were about three or four people, teachers in the department, and there were 450 students in the entire college. So it was a comparatively small music department and a small college.
How large a choir did you have at that time?
Well, it was usually around 60.
And today?
Not much more, 65 perhaps. Depending on what talent there is.
How have you gone about trying to build a very strong program? Because it's obvious from the work that and the recognition that Concordia has received because of you and the choir, that it is recognized as being a very fine choir.
You mean you're talking about the choir now or the music department?
Well, let's deal with the choir first and then the music department second.
Well, the choir, I think, again, it's a lot I owe to my father because he studied in Leipzig and composition and violin. And while he was there, he listened to the St. Thomas Choir, which was directed by Gustav Schreck at the time. And it was Bach's former church choir. And he remembered the sounds of this choir when he came to Minnesota in Northfield at St. Olaf. And he started a choir there, which I'm sure was modeled somewhat on the Leipzig St. Thomas Choir. And this influenced a lot of the choirs around the country in the United States, including mine. So I could say it goes back to really the German culture. The Bach culture that was continued after him by other directors, of course.
Over the years, did you find it difficult to organize the choir with the students? Did you always find that the students were eager to participate?
Oh, there were always lots of students wanting to sing. I think at first nearly half the student body tried out for the choir.
How did you go about selecting them?
Well, we have eliminations. You first individual auditions, and then auditions with each section, bass, tenor, and alto, soprano. And just by listening to them side by side, you try to pick the best talented ones you can pick.
So then in selecting the individuals, you selected on the basis as to what they were capable of doing at that point.
Right.
And then you...
Yeah, try to evaluate the innate talent, what the potential of this student is to be musical and to express through the voice.
What means of financial support were available to you in building a choir, an effective choir?
Well, the college bought the music, but not always very much. I remember we bought one Bach piece. We could only have one copy for two people in the choir. So it wasn't always so easy, but once it got some momentum, then they were willing to spend money for it.
So you find that the financial resources and support are sufficient now?
Oh, yes. And the choir has always made its own way with concerts and paid its own expenses. So it's not a problem.
So the choir, due to its successes, then has been financially self-supporting?
Yes, that's right.
In what ways do they manage to raise their financial support, Paul?
By concerts.
And are these done with paid admissions or
yes,
with free will offerings?
Paid admissions.
Paid admissions. Can you talk about the development of the choir in terms of how you went about starting to you develop these paid admission concerts? And how long did it take before it became an accepted fact that people wanted to come to hear the choir and were willing to pay the
price? They charged $1 a ticket the first year I came. They were evidently used to paying for a choir, college choir.
Mm-hmm. And is
and
that
the dollar at that time, I suppose, was worth $10 now.
And what do you is charged today?
Well, it varies in different towns, but it's, I suppose, from $5 to $12.
You have now found that the administration is very supportive, then, of the college choir?
Oh, yes, they always have been.
What about the music department now? Can you explain some of your experiences in helping to build a strong
music department? Well, I think that grew with the choir because, you know, when you have 200 to 400 students trying out for the choir, then they are also taking voice lessons, they're also taking piano lessons, and they're also taking theory courses. So this whole thing, the choir was a great help to develop the department. Mm-hmm. It drew musically interested students and demanded then that we have more teachers. We had to have more voice teachers, more piano teachers, and more theory teachers in order to accommodate these people interested in music.
What impact have political and economic conditions had on your work and the department and choir?
Well, the first that I've really felt any change has been in the last 5 years. I think ever since I came, the music department was the largest department in the college, and the economic change that has taken place, that now there is more money spent on technology and business, so that now our business department is larger than the music department, and computers and so technology things.
Has this affected the type of support that the music department and the choir receives?
Well, many of the students that normally would have been music majors now are business majors because they can make more money.
Do you find that a lot of these students continue with their interest in music, even though they may choose to major in business?
Well, yes, many of them still try out for the music organizations and play in the orchestra and the band and sing in the choirs, but they don't major in music to make a living from it. They're in business mostly.
What facilities have been available to you and how have they functioned?
Well, we have a very adequate music building that takes care of the rehearsal rooms and the recital rooms, the practice rooms, and the teacher studios, mm-hmm. classrooms.
Would you like to have any other type of physical plant or facility?
Well, the
available?
Only thing I think both the towns are in Fargo Moorhead are in need of a fine auditorium for music.
Are there any technological changes that have taken place that have affected or impacted your work?
Well, the change in modern music has certainly changed the difficulty of music that singers have to encompass with electronic music and a lot of music required that even imitates electronic music and makes it a very taxing problem for singers, because much easier for an instrumentalist to play odd intervals and difficult passages than it is to sing the passages. They can put their finger down and make a note, but a singer has to actually find the note in his own voice, you see, and it's much more difficult. So that has been, the music that is sung is much more difficult than it used to be.
In your opinion, what does the future hold for the arts within the Fargo-Moorhead community?
Well, I think the two towns have supported the arts quite well. And I think we can be quite proud that we have a fine symphony and an opera, and we have many plays being given. All the colleges are producing art in different ways. So I think the future looks good for continuing the development of the arts.
What elements, Paul, do you feel are essential to the growth, change, success, or failure of your individual expression?
I'm not sure if I understand that question.
I think what we're trying to get at, perhaps, is...
I express myself in conducting and in writing music. And the only limitation one has in those two fields are your own imagination. You have all the world's literature, music, to draw on, and it's only your imagination to what you can make of it. And the same is true in writing. There's no limit to what you can write. Its only limitation is what your imagination. So that's unlimited, really.
Follow that a little further. How do you go about, then, with your imagination?
Well, as a conductor, you first examine the score that you're going to conduct in a most careful way to find out the composer's intentions, what his material is and how he's developing his material, and what things should be emphasized in it, what are the important motives in it, and what things should be more in the background. And there's an infinite amount of detail that must go into your study of the score to start with. And then it is to figure out how to help the singers realize these musical dreams of the composer as seen through your eyes, the conductor. And so you have those two aspects, studying the score and then helping the singers to realize the score.
How do you go about doing the latter part, helping the singers to realize?
Well, they have to be taught habits of singing. How diction, for instance, is a very important part of it, and voice production, how to produce a good tone, a rich tone, a full tone, different types of color of tone. They have just sung mostly when they've been in high schools, and they have to be taught many of the refinements of the possibilities of expression in the voice. And so that they can fulfill the many-faceted emotional needs of all the composers.
In working, then, with the students in the choir, I would assume that you've developed some very close relationships with them and watching their development over the years.
Well, when you work hard and even suffer a little with people, you become closer to them. You strive to do something well, and you try to figure out ways to do it better, and you work at it. Well, you're bound to like people that will expend their energy in this same interest that you have. So you do become attached to each other, the students, and I to them, they to each other. Because of, it's not like a team, a football team or anything else. They become attached because they work together and strive together. And this is good for anybody, of course, to have a unified effort for the common production of something, in this case, music.
Have you kept in touch with many of your former choir members?
Oh, yes. They're located. Many of them have good conducting jobs all over the country, and I see them when I travel, and when they go through, they usually stop and visit.
Who are some of these individuals who are also conducting now?
Oh, they're all over. There's Danny Moe has been the head of the choral department at Iowa University, and now he's at Oberlin in Ohio, Oberlin Conservatory. And men like him, there's The Whitey Wold is at River Falls, Wisconsin, in the college directing, and Vernon Opheim is at Minnesota Duluth, has the choral. They're all over, and in high schools and as well as colleges. So it's there is some satisfaction in seeing that take place.
We've discussed how you go about pursuing your work as a choir director. What about now in terms of when you are composing with your writing?
Well, I have several different ways, and I write for several different reasons. The one is for a specific event, like every Christmas I have to write some special music that is only used for that one time. And so that's one kind of music. And that has to be in an idiom that the general public can readily understand and respond to and empathize with, because we're not striving to show any new developments in music, but to make a Christmas experience for everybody. So that's one kind of writing. And then I'm a great believer in folk songs, because they arise not by one composer, but by a people. And you have folk songs arising as work songs or as love songs, or they're very universal in that they come not as just one man's idea, but sort of out of the grassroots of a culture. And so I have used a lot of folk music for that reason. It's the universality of it is what appeals to people. It's because it has been really made by many people over a long period of time. And so I have made arrangements of these folk songs, which can be sung in concert, as many others have. So that's another kind of writing. And then a third kind, which was really my original love in any composer, where he is writing entirely only for his imagination, music for music's sake, and not for any specific event or group. And that is limitless, of course. There you can do anything and let your imagination go. And but there's very little call for that kind of music, because it's usually too difficult for many choirs to sing.
So then you have a lot of then unperformed compositions.
Yes, I do. I remember when I was quite young, I took a semester off and lived in New York City, listening to concerts and writing. And I had six new compositions out of that semester. And I took them to six different publishers in New York City and was turned down by all six. So they sit on the shelf, you see. Mm-hmm. And I do them with my own choir, but they're not published, so nobody else do them. And that's the way it is many times when you have a more individualistic idiom. It's not as universal as a simple folk song. Everybody can understand that, you know. And so it's not many choirs would find really more difficult music practical. Church choirs and high school choirs wouldn't be singing music that is so taxing. So that is a luxury to write like that.
So you have to be fairly versatile with these three distinctive areas of
That's
composition.
Right.
Do you have a procedure you follow when you are going to start to attempt to compose in any of those three areas?
No, it...
discipline you impose upon yourself?
It comes in different ways. Sometimes I would get an idea, musical idea, and that would lead to an elongated piece, and then I would have to find words for it, if it were for a choir. And otherwise, it can work the other way, where you are given a poem or some words, and then you try to invent music to those words. I do it both ways.
Do you do this process when you've hibernated somewhere off at the lake or
in
your study?
I've done some work at the lake, and I do some work in town. Mm-hmm. That's not important. You probably should have a piano and a pencil and some music manuscript paper.
Looking over the years from around 1935 to the present time now, with your experiences, what problems have you encountered, and how did you deal with them?
Well, I suppose I've encountered them all and dealt with them the best I could. It's nothing unusual, I don't think, unless you're speaking about developing a choir. Or is that what you're referring to? Well,
focus
then
on that.
There are common problems there. It takes so much time. And if you have ideals, you want to realize those ideals as well as you can to get some musical satisfaction. And to do that, you see, if you want to have a professional or a really artistic group, you are dealing with young students who are not professionally trained. And if you want to bring them to a level of, say, a symphony in a large town where you have all professional players, then you have a long ways to have to bring those students to that level, because the musicians in this big city symphonies, they've practiced all their lives, and they can do most anything you ask them. But college students have not had a great experience musically to this time, and so you have that distance to try to bring them from. They come from smaller high schools, many of them, and they haven't had a great deal of serious music experience, and so you have to try to help them understand the music, which is new to many of them, and then how to produce it, how to use their voices, and to try to bring it up to some kind of professional acceptable musician's level. And of course that is a major task, to bring amateurs to the status of a professional. But that has always been my ideal, and I think it was my father's ideal before me, because he was a violinist and he played the Minneapolis Symphony, and so he had this as his guide in producing choirs. It had to be as good as the symphony.
And you've used the same standard.
The same standard of intonation and beauty of tone, all these musical phrasing things and everything you expect from a fine symphony. And I think there are two write-ups of my choirs that I have really cherished. The others don't matter, but those two I have cherished. One was in Washington, D.C., when they said that the New York Philharmonic, the Boston Symphony, and the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the National Symphony all play in Washington in these 2 weeks, and none of them are more beautiful than this choir.
It's a wonderful tribute.
That was the best write-up I ever got, you see, in this country.
What was the other one that you had mentioned?
Well, it was in the sort of the middle of my experience with the Concordia Choir. It was About halfway through, and it was in a European trip, we sang in Vienna, and they said the same thing. We have not heard a more beautiful sound than this choir can produce. Mm-hmm. And those two newspaper things I've always cherished because of my interest in the instrumental values, the professional instrumental values, musicianship and so on.
How has your involvement in music affected your personal life?
Well, it's for a musician, you can't really separate it. You are a musician, it is part of your life, and I think it's the way it must be. The advice my father gave me, if you can avoid music, avoid it. And so if you can't avoid it, then you're part of it, you see. And that's, I think, good advice.
Why would he say avoid it if you can? What are some of the hidden pitfalls?
Well, he would say it because it's so frustrating if you don't love it, to have to work so hard to get so little. But if you love it, then you see the work is, love the results. So, and then it's a gratifying way to spend your life.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come this afternoon to speak with us.
Thank you.